Well, the Kentucky Derby is the biggest horse race of the year. How many of you ever been to the Kentucky Derby before? Anybody ever been to it? How many of you watched it on TV? Some people, right? Us in Georgia, we don't understand like the folks in Kentucky, right? It takes place every May at Churchill Downs, this historic racetrack in Louisville, Kentucky. But what you may not know is that really the center of horse country is not in Louisville, where we all celebrate the big race. The center of horse country is really about an hour and a half east of Louisville in a place called Lexington, Kentucky. And I started to get very fond of that place because when I was in grad school in seminary studying to be a pastor, I lived just outside of Lexington. And you got to know, man, if you've ever been to Lexington, it is beautiful. It's beautiful. I remember seeing this. They call it Kentucky bluegrass. I don't know why it's called bluegrass, but the grass is so green that I felt like there was like tips of blue on the top of it. Like it's just so much grass, beautiful grassland. There's also these long black fence lines for the horses that go for miles and miles and miles. There's these rolling hills, and I remember there's also these majestic barns that you see. I remember one time I was in seminary, and I got invited to play a basketball game, to go play basketball with some guys in seminary at a barn. And I was like, oh boy, we're going to a barn in Kentucky. What's this going to be about? And I walked in, and that place looked better than most arenas, right? The barns are majestic and beautiful and have all sorts of things from basketball to horse stuff. And you also find in the middle of Lexington some of the best horses in the world. Some of them have been bought for over $1 million, right, to be trained and bred. But anyway, right in Lexington, Kentucky, there's another famous racetrack there called Keeneland. And Keeneland is another great race. Here's a picture of me and Mandy when we went to Keeneland when I was in seminary. It was, you can see we're like young pups there. But man, it was freezing cold that day. So if we look like we're cold, we were. And it was not that fun. It was fun, but it was a little bit miserable at the same time because it was so cold there that day. But anyway, you can kind of see a little bit of Keeneland. In fact, one of the things I want you to know about Keeneland is you go to the horse race and the admission is only $5. That's a good deal, right? And they're expecting you to spend money on other things like gambling and stuff, but we went the cheap route, right? We'd pay $5 and we'd just pick a horse that we wanted and we'd cheer for that baby. We didn't have to pay for anything and we came out ahead of everybody else, right? But it's this amazing pageantry at Keeneland. Here's a real picture of what Keeneland looks like in the spring. I mean, this is just beautiful. And what you see when you go to Keeneland, you'll see all types of people in different types of attire, but you see a lot of women wearing sundresses and those big hats. You go to Macy's or somewhere up there, they sell these massive hats that you see at the Kentucky Derby, right, around Derby time. And then, not only that, but you'll find men that are wearing, suits and stuff like that. Kind of interesting. And also, as you... As you do all that, the jockeys, are these tiny little men that are great at guiding the horses, but not a stitch is out of place on their clothing. The horses, they look smaller right here, but they're massive. They're massive horses, beautiful animals. And as you watch these guys, a bugler actually comes out and blows, kind of announces that the horses and the jockeys announces them to come out. So it's this amazing scene. We'll save that picture. And I want to take you to another place. When I was in, every single year, every single summer, my family takes a beach vacation to Daytona Beach. And Daytona Beach is, obviously, it's known for NASCAR and all sorts of things. They don't have horse races, but one of our favorite things to do is go to the dog races, It's kind of like the horse race, but it's a little different. The NASCAR track, the Daytona Speedway, is right down the street. And let's just say that the scenery or the clientele is a little bit more like the Redneck Riviera, compared to the scene at Keeneland, right? You won't find the fancy attire of hats and sundresses and suits, right? But what you will find is a lot of dogs and the scent of dogs everywhere, right? And so anyway, we go to the dog races, and my kids absolutely love it. They love to pick a dog, to see it ahead of time, and to say, I want the red one. And they almost always win, right? If we ever bet money, we would do pretty well because of my kids. But anyway, but they love it. But anyway, one thing has always bothered me that's different from horse racing when it comes to the dog races. Here's a picture of the dog races. One thing that's always bothered me is you know, the trainers or the people who are loading the handlers, they load the dogs into this gate just like in horse racing. And they get to the place, and they run back, and all of a sudden, this mechanical fake bunny starts coming around the track. You know, it's like basically a metal arm with a fake bunny on it, and it comes around the track, and the announcer says, here comes Lucky, right? The bunny's name is Lucky, I guess, you know? So here comes Lucky. The gates open, and he says, and they're off, the five, the four, and he starts saying all this stuff that I don't know, sounds like gibberish, but he eventually announces the winner, right? And I watch these dogs run around the track. They run all the way around the track, chasing the rabbit. I'm going to get it. And all of a sudden, somebody who works there closes the fence right as the bunny goes by, and the dogs almost like run into the fence, right? They don't ever let the dog get the rabbit. And I watched this race after race after race, and eventually I was like, you know what? I hope that thing breaks because I want one of those dogs to get that rabbit. I'm tired of seeing the bunny win, the rabbit win. That's probably why they call it Lucky, because he always wins, right? But it's one of those things where that no matter how long they chase the rabbit, they never got there. And I tell you that story, I set it up like that because I think that this story is a microcosm of a story that so many people live today. In a lot of ways, I think we all fall into a very similar pattern in our lives as those dogs who are chasing the rabbits. Because in a lot of ways, in our culture today, we're surrounded by messages that are telling us that if you want to be happy, chase the rabbit. Chase the rabbit. Chase things that you can't ever fully get a hold of, you know? And so, for instance, it's promises like this. If we just chase after more, if we chase after more money, more stuff, more items, new stuff, more stuff, then we'll be content. Then you'll be popular. Then you'll be, successful. Then you'll be happy. If you could just get more, then you'll have what you always wanted. But the problem is the pursuit of more never ends, right? The problem with the endless pursuit of more is never enough. Because what happens once you get that thing that you thought was going to make you satisfied, that place or that position, that thing in your life that you thought was going to make you happy, once you're there, the needle always moves. The needle always moves to what you don't have next. And so having the bigger and better and newer and more is like chasing the rabbit. It promises something that it can't ever fully fulfill. And I tell you that because today we're going to be looking at a story, a parable that Jesus told. And Jesus is wanting to speak into not only our culture, but he wants to speak to you today. And he wants to give you good news. It'll start out as hard news, but it's good news of a better way, a way that we can live a better way. And in Luke chapter 12, that's where it's found, Luke chapter 12, what's happening is a crowd has gathered around. They're following Jesus everywhere. And at the beginning of Luke chapter 12, it gives this really interesting detail where it says basically that people were trampling over each other, trying to get to Jesus. This is kind of, he'd become almost like this rock star. Everybody wanted some of Jesus, you know? And so he's teaching people about the importance of standing up for God in your life, standing up for Jesus in your life. When suddenly, a man stands up for himself in a lot of ways. He stands up, he pushes through the crowd, and he's like, oh, Jesus, I got a question. You know, it's almost like he interrupts. I got a question. I can relate to this as a parent because this is my life nonstop right now, right? It's like Mandy and I are having this deep conversation about something, and our kids have a, daddy, 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 I got a question. Daddy, mommy, I got a question. We're like, what is your question? And it's something that doesn't matter, right? It matters to them, but it's something that's like, that was not urgent, that you had to interrupt the important conversation we were having, right? I get this with Jesus. He's teaching some about basically standing up for God in your life. Make your life not about other things. Make it about God. And all of a sudden, this guy's like, ah, I got a question, Jesus. And it's funny because I started to think, if you were to ask Jesus one question, what might you ask Jesus? You know, like, what might you ask Jesus? Now, here this guy is, what we're going to find out is he's actually pushing through the crowd because he's basically wanting to ask Jesus to help him get more money. You know, maybe you've seen the recent Aladdin movie. You know, he's trying to treat Jesus like the genie in a bottle. He's trying to say, oh, Jesus, grant me this wish. Give me more money, right? And so here's how the story goes, starting in verse 13. Luke chapter 12, starting in verse 13. It says, someone in the crowd said to him, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. It says this, Jesus replied, man, who appointed me a judge or an arbitrator between you? Then he said to them, watch out. Be on guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions, right? This is interesting here. It's interesting that Jesus says, watch out for all kinds of greed, all forms of greed. Beware of power and money and stuff. Beware of coveting what you don't have. It's like, why are you talking about that, Jesus? He just wanted to share the inheritance. Like, he just wanted more of the inheritance. Well, it's because Jesus looks deep down in his life, and he's like, this is not really about fairness. This is about there's something in your heart where you're always wanting more. And so this connotation, this phrase of all kinds of greed, it's this connotation of he's always reaching. You know, you're always reaching. And it's like, it means like you're always looking around for more. You're always reaching out for more, never being content with what you have and what you've been given and what God has already put in your life and your hands. You're never content because you're always reaching for more. And so this guy in the story, he already had, I want you to notice this. He already had some inheritance. The Jewish law was really clear on this. He already had some inheritance. In fact, here's how Jewish law worked. Well, let me tell you, in today's culture, if you get a share of the inheritance, let's say you have four siblings, usually the parents split it up evenly with the four. I don't want to get in a family fight. Maybe your family does it differently, but I'm just saying, that's how it kind of typically goes, right? Now, here's the thing. There's a lot of family drama when it comes to inheritance. And so here, but in Jewish culture, what would happen is the oldest, it would all go to the sons. Sorry, women, that's just the way it was, right? It would all go to the sons, and the oldest son would get a double portion of the inheritance. Well, that's not fair, right? That's not fair, right? The oldest son would get a double share of the inheritance, and then the rest of the inheritance would be split among the other brothers. And so it's like, if you're a second child or a third child, it's like, well, that's how it always has been in my family, right? The oldest always gets the stuff, right? I get the hand-me-downs. And this is this guy. He's like, why am I the one not getting double? Well, in Jesus' culture, it's because the oldest son would get a double portion because they would be responsible, therefore, of managing the whole family, of taking care of the family. And so Jewish law was, hey, let's give the oldest son, who has to take care of more people, let's give him a double share and then split the rest with everybody. That's how they did things. And so here, this passage, this is clearly a younger brother, isn't it? It's clearly a younger brother who's looking at his older brother and what he has versus what he's been given. And he's coming to Jesus and he's saying, this isn't fair about my share, right? This isn't fair about my share. Like, why does he get more than me? Make my brothers just split the inheritance with me, right? And so in the middle of this fairness talk, Jesus looks in his heart and here's what he says. He's like, whoa, 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 beware. He uses this guy as an example. Beware, he says. Watch out. Be on guard against all forms of greed. And so this watch out idea, it's this phrase that has this connotation that we're all under attack. So Jesus goes real deep, real quick, right? It's this idea that we're all under attack from the temptation to covet, from the temptation to want what we don't have. And what he's saying is if we want to be faithful to God and if we want to be happy in our lives, that we have to fight against that desire. We have to push against that desire and protect ourselves from falling into the same pattern as everybody else. And so beware of always reaching for more. I mean, that's Jesus' message to his culture, and that's Jesus' message for us today. Now, this is where we raise up our hands and we say, well, Jesus, you don't understand. Like, our culture is a lot more difficult. I mean, there's a lot more messages that are pulling us. In fact, we live in a world today where I believe the gravitational pull of culture is always urging us to reach for more. Can you relate to that? It's always saying, reach for more, go get this. Just look online. You go on Facebook and there's ads that start popping up. You're just wanting to see what somebody ate for breakfast, and all of a sudden they're trying to sell you something, right? You drive down the street on the way to church and there's billboards that start saying what you need to do with your life and what you need to buy, what you need to have. Same when you turn on the TV and there's commercials trying to entice you to get stuff. And stuff isn't bad, but we're bombarded with marketing things, with marketing messages telling us that we've got to have what we don't yet have. And it's more tempting than ever. It's more tempting than ever to fall into this trap that says, if I could just have that, if I could just have this, then I'll be happy. If I could just have this, then we'll be content. And I get this. I see it. It's summertime. My kids are around. And they, y'all, this is crazy. So Peyton found this iPhone 5. I don't know where he got it. It was one of our old phones, an iPhone 5. It's so ancient, man. You know, this iPhone 5 that was sitting on a counter. And he said, Mom, Dad, is this, Mommy, Daddy, is this what a phone used to look like? And we're like, brother, it's not that old, okay? Like, we used to have the flip phones, you know, and all that stuff. You know, back in the day, we used to plug our phones into a car, right? We used to have a cord that was connected to the house, you know, and you had to walk around, and you'd get twisted in it. You don't know ancient, right? But he says, is this what a phone used to look like? And we're like, yes, it's what a phone used to look like 2 years ago, okay? And he said, since this is right here, can I have this iPhone? And we're like, you're six? No, right? But it is always this wanting and striving and wanting to have more. It's like, you don't even know what to do with that, you know? And so I get this. It's all around us, this temptation that newer, bigger, better, more will satisfy me. In fact, if you follow the history of advertising in America, it's fascinating in this regard. The history of advertising. Let me explain it like this. Let's say that we're all vacuum cleaner salesmen or saleswomen, because that's just kind of the stereotypical. You sell vacuum cleaners. That sounds like a kind of funny thing to do. Or let's say we're selling a clothing brand. So let's kind of go through this. In the 1900s, in the early 1900s, the way advertising would work is advertisers pretty much focused on the product. They focused on the features of the product. And so if it was a vacuum, The advertisers would say, they would say, well, this vacuum cleaner has 4-horsepower motor. I don't even know like how much that is, but that might be really fast, right? But that sounds really good, right? 4-horsepower motor. And they would say, oh, this is the suckiest vacuum cleaner on the market, or whatever, right? They'd say whatever about the features of the product. And so you get what I mean, okay? on the other hand, they would say, oh, this clothing brand, you know, it has the finest organic cotton. It would tell you about the features of the product, right? And so you'd want to buy it. And then what they finally started to realize after the turn of the century is advertisers started to realize that, you know, instead of just focusing on the features of the product, let's start telling people, like, why they need the product, the benefits the product will have on their life. And so they started to say things about things like this. They started to say, like a vacuum cleaner. This vacuum cleaner gets twice the amount of dirt as the leading brand. You maybe have heard that, right? That is telling you the benefits. Buy this, and it cleans double as good as the other one. Or if it was clothing brand, they would say it's not just about the organic cotton. They would say this clothing line is more comfortable clothing for you. But then, when we get about to the 1950s, advertising started to change. There was a shift that started to happen, and they started to realize that instead of just, they could get us to buy stuff more if they don't just tell us about the features, and they don't just tell us about the benefits, but let's start focusing on identity branding. For instance, suddenly advertisers started inviting us to form our identity, to base our identity on their products, right? And so instead of saying, well, this vacuum cleaner has a 4-horsepower engine motor, they would start to say, here's a famous ad of what they used to say from Hoover. They started to say things like this: you'll be happier with a Hoover. So all of a sudden, my happiness is tied into my vacuum cleaner, right? And this is so, like, gender stereotypic, so excuse that, right? Because, you know, you see the women doing it. It's like, just forgive that part. This is the 1950s. It's not about us. It's about what they did. But what they would say oftentimes is they would say things about the women. They would say, And they would show this idea, be the wife you've always wanted to be, get our product. Be the woman you've always wanted to be, get our product, and you can be that. Or for the men, let's say it's a clothing brand, they would say, not about the features, they would say, be a man of style, right? And all of a sudden, we started buying stuff like crazy. And because we began to build our identity based on the products that we had or the things that we didn't have. The luxury brand started taking off like crazy, and we started to say, I've got to have that really nice souped-up car because, man, I'm going to look like something if I get that, right? I got to have that house because, man, if I get that, people are going to think I'm something. Here's a little bit more modern example that you may remember. The commercial where the guy, a really cool guy, would stand up, and he would say, I'm a Mac, right? And he was this really cool guy that was like, man, I want to be like that. And on the other side would say, this kind of guy that's not as cool would say, I'm a PC. And it's like, which one do you want to be, right? Do you want to be this guy and own a Mac, or do you want to be this guy and own a PC? Or how about this? I'm a Ford truck guy, right? And that's an identity thing. I'm a Chevy guy. And there's different identity that's formed into what we own. And so I'm the house that I have. I'm the car that I drive. I'm the brand that I wear. And what Jesus is saying to us in our culture today is beware. Beware of this kind of idea, because life is about so much more than the abundance of possessions. Like, if you make your life about that, you'll drive yourself crazy, right? Because when we begin to define our life and our identity around what we have or what we own, around our stuff, when we start reaching for more and reaching for what we don't have, what happens is we find ourselves caught in debt today. We find ourselves, you know, getting caught in this anxiety of trying to maintain a certain lifestyle. We find ourselves getting caught always looking at our and huddling over our savings account that we work so hard to have, right? And it's one of those things where we're thinking that it'll make us secure. What Jesus is saying is beware of all forms of greed. Beware of all forms of reaching. So here's the bottom line I want to share with you today, and it's this. Is that life is not about reaching for more. It's about leveraging more of your life for God. Life is not about reaching for more. It's about leveraging more of your life for God. That's the remedy, isn't it? I mean, the invitation of Jesus is not stop being greedy, right? That's not helpful. Like, okay, all right, what else do I pursue? It's this idea of repenting. It's the Bible word for repent. It basically, repent means not to be sorry for what you did, but repent literally means to turn your life in a completely different direction. Your life is headed in one direction. I'm reaching for more, and Jesus is saying, there's a better way. Why don't you repent, turn your life in the opposite direction, and start pursuing something bigger? Why don't you start leveraging more of your life, more of your stuff, more of your resources, more of your family, more of your time, more of who you are for God? Like, that's the invitation. That's the remedy. See, we get this mixed up a lot, that we oftentimes think that our value is based on what we have. But in reality, you are valuable because of God's love for you, right? You're valuable because of God's love for you. Everything changes when you realize I don't have to keep reaching and striving to earn something more or to be something more, to have something more. I don't have to do those things. Because God has already reached out his hands on the cross for me. He's already gained and won my approval. Like, we are who we are because of God's love for us. And so I want to tell you today that you are not the sum of what you have. That your value is not wrapped up in the sum of what you've accomplished, whether it's good or bad. Like, you know, it's one of those things that your identity is this. You are loved by God. You have been chosen by God. You have been bought with a price, the highest price of his son Jesus on the cross. You are loved by God. You're a child of God. And when you realize that, you can suddenly stop reaching to try to accomplish more, to become more, and you can be set free to leverage who you are for the sake of God. And so Jesus then tells this parable. It's a made-up parable. It's a story about a guy. It's this parable of the rich fool. And here's how it continues, verse 16. Here's what he says. And Jesus told them this parable. It says, the ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. Translation, we're not a farming culture today, so we don't kind of get this. He planted a lot of stuff, he worked really hard, and all of a sudden it produced way more than he ever imagined. This is an abundant harvest. Wow, so much stuff, so much blessing. Picture you walk into the office and all of a sudden you're promoted and you're given a salary that's bigger than what you expected, right? A certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. Verse 17, it says, he thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. I've got all this stuff, all this blessing. There's all this need around me. What should I do, right? Verse 18, it says, then he said, this is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. It says this, verse 19, it says, and I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool. Wait a minute. I was tracking with the story until God called this guy a fool. Like, you fool? Like, what, really? Like, you fool? It's kind of like, okay, if we were to walk into a bookstore together, right? If we were to all go into a bookstore today, we get a Starbucks drink, we start walking through the aisles of the bookstore, we would probably see a whole lot of people who wrote books by guys like this, right? Yeah, guys who have accomplished something and is telling us how we can do it too. I mean, can't you just see the book? Like, maybe the book would be titled this, How I Farmed My Way to Financial Freedom and How You Can Too. I mean, this would be a bestseller. We would buy this book. We want to be this guy. And so this guy has essentially accomplished the American dream, hasn't he? He's gotten there. Like, I mean, isn't that the American dream, you know, to work really hard and be so successful that eventually in our life we have enough saved up that we can retire early, maybe get a vacation home, kick our, you know, feet up and rest for the rest of our lives drinking pina coladas on the beach, amen, right? That sounds good, doesn't it? So I want you to know that the problem Jesus is talking about, the problem is not that this guy is rich. Jesus is not saying, hey, you're a fool because you're rich. No, you're probably wise because you were able to accomplish all that. The problem is this guy's selfish. It's all about he's selfish. See, this guy's life, he made all of his possessions and all of his life. His life was not about God and it wasn't about others. He made his life all about himself. In fact, check out. Here's the clues. And notice the personal pronouns. They're all selfish. Here's what he says. He says, my crops, tear down my barns, store my grain, my goods. And he says to himself, you have plenty. And so what Jesus is not saying you're a fool if you have a bunch of stuff. You're a fool if you're rich. That's not what he's saying. What Jesus is saying is this, your life and your stuff is never just about you. And when you make your life and your stuff just about you, you've missed everything. Here's a big truth I want to share with you today, and it's this, is that if you make your possessions just about you, your possessions will often possess you. If you make your possessions just about you, your possessions will often possess you. What does that mean? Well, it's kind of this thing where when you form your identity based on what you have or what you don't have, you know, you suddenly become a prisoner to those possessions. You start running after and chasing those things. It drives your life instead of using your resources to accomplish what you want to accomplish in the world, right? And see, we become a fool when we spend our life and we spend our money all on ourselves. That's what he's saying. Let me ask you this question. Have you ever seen somebody, they take a selfie? Maybe they buy a house or they buy a car, right? And they take a selfie and they post it online, and they say, bought a car, hashtag blessed. You ever seen that before? Hashtag blessed. Now, there's nothing wrong with hashtag blessed. But sometimes we don't understand the biblical view of blessing, right? Sometimes we think that it's kind of like, you know, I got this, I was able to buy this, I was able to acquire something, hashtag blessed. But in the Bible, hashtag blessed is never just about you. In fact, all the way back in the Old Testament, in the story of a guy named Abram, you may know him as Abraham. God comes to this guy named Abram who was a nobody. He was a nomadic kind of guy. And God comes to him, and he was so old that he wasn't able to have kids at the time. And God says to him, hey, look up at the stars and count them if you can. I'm going to give you descendants as numerous as the stars. Now, one of the things I love to do, my kids love to look at stars. I've kind of maybe taught them that. Like, we always look out at the stars and we try to point out different things. And especially my daughter, Kelsey, she loves when we go into kind of a dark area where, you know, you can see a lot of stars. In fact, in Kentucky, it was amazing. There's more stars than I've ever seen in the sky. And here in the Middle East, supposedly I haven't been there before, but supposedly the skylight, it's so dark that the sky is just encrusted with diamonds, like all the stars are encrusted like diamonds. And so when God says to Abram, look at the stars and count them if you can, he's like, nope, it's more than anybody could ever count. And he says, I'm going to give you this many descendants. And he says, and I'm going to bless you so that you can be a blessing. Through you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed because of you. I'm blessing you so that you can be a blessing. And so that's what being blessed is all about. You are blessed by God so that, hashtag, you can be a blessing to others. You're blessed to be a blessing. And see, blessing isn't just about the stuff itself. Blessing, your resources gives you the opportunity to participate with God in what God is already wanting to do in the world, to redeem the world. God is inviting you to make your stuff not about you, but to leverage who you are and to leverage your stuff for the sake of a higher purpose, to make it about God. And so the resources, the greater your resources, the greater the responsibility to be a blessing. That's why this guy was a fool. He missed it. And so here's the bottom line. Life is not about reaching for more. It's about leveraging more of your life for God. It's about leveraging more of your life for God. Let's continue. Let's finish the story. Verse 20. It says this. It says, but God said to him, you know, he said, I'll eat, drink, be merry. I'm going to, you know, rest up my feet, drink pina coladas on the beach, right? Retire early. Here's what he says. But God said to him, you fool. This very night, your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? Translation, nobody. This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich toward God. And so here's the thing. When our life is over someday, right? When our life is over, everything that's been filled up in our own barns, what Jesus is saying is it won't matter anymore. It doesn't matter about all these identity things, the car you drive and the things that you have. But everything that we've stored up for the kingdom of God, it's going to last forever. I mean, that's one of the things that I love about when people serve in the community. When we offer our kids camp in just a couple weeks, Extreme Games, we get to serve over 300 kids, right? It's one of the biggest opportunities to be a blessing in people's lives. And what we start to realize is my life is no longer about hashtag me being blessed. Or me being, you know, me just whatever's best for me. But all of a sudden, we start serving somebody else, and we start realizing, wow, we are sowing seeds in the lives of kids and the lives of families, and those things that we're investing in there, and in the faith of those families, that's something that's going to last for all of eternity. And so we have a choice in our life. We can either fill up our barn or our treasure only for ourselves, or we can choose to also be rich toward God. And so let me ask you this question. If you look at your life, if you look at your possessions, if you look at the way you live, what story are you living? What story are you living? And this is why it's a tough story. Jesus tells us this so that we can look at our lives, right? But let me tell you this story. John Wesley started the Methodist movement in the 1700s. And he taught us how to a lot of things, but how to also live wisely when it comes to our resources, how to be rich to God, toward God. And John Wesley once said this. He said, earn all you can, save all you can, and give all you can. Earn all you can. In other words, it's not a sin to have a whole lot. Like, that can be a huge blessing that you can leverage for something greater. Earn all you can, save all you can, and give all you can. But John Wesley didn't just talk about it, he lived it. John Wesley lived on about 28 pounds, British pounds. He lived in England, about 28 British pounds his entire life. And as his income grew more and more during his life, he continued to live on that on 28 pounds. And so his income grew from 28 pounds to 30 pounds to 60 to 90. By the end of his life, he had more than he ever imagined. He was making 120 pounds. But instead of raising his standard of living, you know, instead of raising his standard of living, building a bigger barn, storing up more for himself, John Wesley said, no, I'm going to raise my standard of giving. He lived at the same place that he was so that he could be more generous to God and more generous to people around him, because he understood that your life is not about collecting the abundance of possessions. Instead, it's about leveraging who you are for God. And so my prayer for you is that we would not keep chasing rabbits, you know? My prayer is that we wouldn't buy the lie that life is about reaching more, but we would find a way to leverage more of our life for God. How might you do that?